Devate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 4, Chapter 25, The Characteristics of King Paranjana, Text 38. It's 37, excuse me. Okay. Well, first I'd like to welcome our guests from the Jesuit Center in Culver City. They're members of a Catholic religious order studying for their priesthood. So we're very happy to have them here today. So the Srimad Bhagavatam is our primary scripture. It contains the philosophical basis of the Krishna consciousness movement. It has elements of cosmology, theology, ethics, history, a whole lot of different subjects. So each day we study one text from it. First we'll recite the Sanskrit, which you see transliterated on the board there. And then we'll read a translation and a purport, and then I'll say a few words about it, and then there'll be a chance for the devotees and yourselves to ask questions. Imam tvam adityashtasva purim nava mukim vibho mayopanitan greenanaha kama bogan Shatam Samaha Imam Tvam Adityashtasva Purim Nava Mukim Vibho Mayopanitan Grinana Kama Bogan Shatam Samaha Imam Tvamadi Tishtashva Purim Nava Mukim Vibhu Vayopanitan Grinana Kama Bogan Shatam Samaha Imam Tvam Adityashtasva Purim Nava Mukim Vibho Mayopanitan Grinana Kama Bogan Shatam Samaha
Shatam Parichishtasva Vrinavamukhinivo Yoparitam Vinana Kamabodam Shamasata Nam Tva Marichishtasva Vrinavamukhinivo Yoparitam Vinana
Ladies,
Mantra Maritishtasva Vrinava Mukhimibo Aropanitam Vinana Amabodam Shatam Sama Mantra Maritishtasva Vrinava Mukhimibo Mayopanitan Vrinana Kamabodam Samsama Mantra Maritishtasva Vrinava Mukhimibo
Imam, this, Tvam, your good self, Adityashtasva, just remain, Purim, in the city, Navamukim, with nine gates, Vibo, O my Lord, Maya, by me, Upanitan, arranged, Grinataha, taking, Kamabhogan, the materials for sense gratification, Shatam, 100, Samaha, years. Translation and purport by His Divine Grace Srila Prabhupada. I just mentioned the word Lord that's mentioned here. It's not referring to God. It's a just term of, it's being used in this sense in term of respect, you know, for a respectable person. So, translation, my dear Lord, I have just arranged the city of nine gates for you so that you can have all kinds of sense gratification. You may live here for 100 years and everything for your sense gratification will be supplied. Please repeat. My dear Lord, I have just arranged the city of nine gates for you so that you can have all kinds of sense gratification. You may live here for 100 years and everything for your sense gratification will be supplied. Report. Dharma Arta Kama Mokshanam Dara Samprapti Hetavaha. The wife is the cause of all kinds of success in religion, economic development, sense gratification, and ultimately salvation. When one accepts a wife, it is to be understood that he is being helped in his progressive march towards liberation. In the beginning of life, a person is trained as a brahmachari and is then allowed to marry a suitable girl and become a householder. If one is thoroughly trained in household life, he finds all facilities for human life, eating, sleeping, mating, and defending. Everything is there if it is executed according to regulative principles. Om Jnana Timurandasya Gananjana Shalakaya Chakshura Militam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhar Shri Vasudhi Gaura Bhaktivinoda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare. So the translation again: My dear Lord, I have arranged this city of nine gates for you so that you can have all kinds of sense gratification. You may live here for 100 years and everything for your sense gratification will be supplied. So for the benefit of our guest, I'll put this in context. These words are being spoken by a saintly person, a great sage named Narada Muni, to a king named Paranjana. Of course, a king is a very powerful person. You know, a king has lots of wealth and power and opportunities for sense gratification. So in many cases, people in powerful positions, they forget, you know, the spiritual purpose of life. So to remind the king of his spiritual purpose in life, you know, the great sage Narada Muni tells him a story, an allegory. And the allegory is called the City of Nine Gates. And in this, the name of the king was who's hearing this is King Prachini Barhishat. So Narada Muni tells him this allegory about the City of Nine Gates. And in this story, there's another king. Of course, if you're telling somebody a story, it's good to tell them a story about someone they can identify with. So he says, once there was a king who was living in a city, and then he decided to leave his home, and he had a friend there who followed him. The friend didn't let him know he was being followed, but he followed the king. So this king went looking around for another place to live, and finally he came to a city with nine gates. And he entered the city, and in the middle of the city he found a beautiful garden, and in this garden there was a beautiful woman who invited him to stay in the city of nine gates, as we're hearing here. Please stay in the city of nine gates, and everything will be fine here. So what happens later in the allegory is that he does stay in the city for nine gates, but then later another king attacks the city and destroys it, and he's taken out. He has to leave, you know, this city of nine gates and be born again. He's born again, and then finally he decides, I'm really tired of all this. And his friend who's been following him says, well, you have another home where you originally came from, and if you like, I can tell you how to get back to it. So you can see the elements of the allegory. It's an allegory of the soul. The soul has an original relationship with God on the spiritual level of existence. If it departs from that position, it comes to this world. And in this world, it lives in a city of nine gates, which is the body, because the body has nine gates. Two eyes, two ears, two nostrils, the mouth, and then there's the openings for evacuation and generation. So the material body, however, is temporary. It's eventually going to be destroyed. So the soul has another home. The real home of the soul is not this body. The real home of the soul is the spiritual world, where it's meant to eternally exist with God. Of course, God is always trying to get us to return to the spiritual world. So this allegory has many different levels to it. The woman the king meets in the beautiful garden is the material intelligence. And the material intelligence is always trying to direct us to forget about the spiritual purpose of life and simply concentrate on material advancement, material pleasures, and things of that sort. So that is the purpose of material intelligence. And the beautiful woman is compared to that intelligence. Of course, there can be many kinds of intelligence. There can also be a spiritual intelligence that leads us back towards God. And that's a good thing. Now, in terms of another level of this allegory, the king is about to accept this woman as his wife. So, on the higher level of the allegory, you could say that means he's agreeing to be led by his material intelligence, which is not necessarily a good thing. It's better to be led by spiritual intelligence. But on another level of the allegory, marriage, in terms of the spiritual life of most people, is considered to be a good thing. Because the sex urge is there in everyone. And according to Vedic civilization, there are different ways to deal with that. In the system of Varnashrama, which is the Vedic style of civilization, there are four stages of life through which a person passes. If we take it from the standpoint of a male person, the first stage of life is called brahmacharya, or celibate student life. And then it's possible to remain for one's entire life a celibate person. That's possible. That's considered to be very good if one can do it. You know, for example, probably in your order, that's a rule. So that's considered very good if someone can do it, but most people can't. So in Vedic civilization, the next stage of life, it's called grihastha life or householder life, religious family life, religious married life. It's not considered just a license for sense gratification, but the husband and wife are supposed to live together in a controlled way and help each other advance in spiritual consciousness and produce children, not just like cats and dogs would produce their kittens and puppies, but consciously, in order to bring a soul into this world, to give it the chance to make spiritual advancement. So that household, in that householder life, sex is allowed for the purpose of procreation. And that's considered to be a good thing. So ideally, that's how, you know, householder life is carried out. Then after some time, when the husband and wife grow older and their children are grown and they no longer are working, then there's the stage of life called vanaprast, which technically means going to the forest. In ancient times, at a certain stage, you know, when the man reached 50 years or 55 years, then he would retire, you know, from family life and literally go to the forest to live a very simple life. And his wife could accompany him. And then for those who were in the higher statuses of life, there would be a final stage called sannyas, or complete renunciation, where, you know, the husband and wife would separate and they would each prepare themselves for leaving this world. So it's, in one sense, you could say it's an aspect of Vedic culture, but in another aspect, these stages of life are more or less natural, and everyone in this world goes through them. You know, by nature's arrangement, until a certain age, children are celibate until they come to the age of puberty. Generally speaking, you know, if you take very young children, you know, grade school age, and you put them all together, they'll sort of naturally separate. You know, the men, you know, the boys will go to one side of the room, the girls will go to another. And then later, at the time of puberty, some attraction, you know, develops. And in modern culture, it's, it's very unrestricted, you know, how the contact between boys and girls, men and women goes on. But in Vedic culture, it was a little bit restricted and regulated. And even today, in pious Hindu families, you know, we see that this is their marriages are arranged. It's not that just people are thrown out into the streets, you know, to find their husband or wife. And it's actually considered, you know, if one has, as stated here, if a man finds a good wife or a wife finds a good husband, it's considered very auspicious, very helpful for their advancement in spiritual life. Of course, as I said, if someone can remain in the ashram of brahmacharya, celibate life, or sannyas life, or renounced life, that's very good, because one can give one's full energy to helping others make advancement in spiritual life. You know, it's considered very good. But for most people, they will generally pass through this stage of married life. And as I said, this is not just an aspect of Vedic culture. It's something that we find generally in the world, that, you know, by nature's arrangement, by God's arrangement, up to a certain age, boys and girls, they are celibate. At a certain age, they become attracted to each other as male and female, and they enter into different arrangements, living together, having children, working. And by nature's arrangement, we also see that at a certain stage, it's not possible for the woman to have more children, and the man grows older and isn't able to work as he did in his younger years, so there's retirement. And then finally, there's renunciation, because either, you know, the husband or the wife leaves this world and the other is left alone. So, in Vedic culture, these natural kind of stages of life are dealt with in a systematic way, so that, you know, during the time when one is naturally celibate, one gets a good education in spiritual principles. And if this is done, then when one enters into householder life, married life, one doesn't use it just as a license for sense gratification, but as I said, the husband and wife cooperate with each other to help each other make spiritual advancement. And if they have children, which happens in most cases, the children get the benefit of having a father and mother who are interested in their spiritual advancement and who make arrangements to help, you know, the child grow up in a spiritual way. And then finally, there's retired life and renounced life. So here, in his purport, Srila Prabhupada says, "The wife is the cause of all kinds of success in religion, economic development, sense gratification, and ultimately salvation." Because we do strive after these things, We need some, a civilized person has to engage in religion, dharma. There has to be artha or economic development. There has to be some kama, some kind of pleasure in this world that people have. And then finally there's moksha or liberation. And a good wife or a good husband can help achieve these goals, can help the family achieve these goals of performing religious principles, of having some kind of economic development by the cooperation of the husband and the wife, and also legitimate pleasure, and also the chance to achieve the real goal of life, which is liberation from the whole cycle of material existence or samsara. When one accepts a wife, Srila Prabhupada said, it is to be understood that he is being helped in his progressive march towards liberation. I mean, sometimes in contemporary society, you know, there's a lot of, you know, like they say, the wife is like the ball and chain or this or that. But yeah, you know, in actual spiritual culture, married life is considered a step up, a step towards the ultimate goal of liberation and returning back to the spiritual world. But even if one does enter married life and has a good married life, still at a certain stage one is expected in Vedic culture to renounce that, to prepare for leaving this world. And those are the stages of vanaprastha, retired life, and sannyas, renounced life. So I'll stop there. Does anybody have any questions or comments? Yes.
Sometimes arranged marriage can be seen opposite in, for some people who's not trained up in Vedic culture. Traditionally in India, the parents, they arrange the marriage because they see that they look after the benefit of their children. And but in the contemporary way now, people don't see that that's actually the best thing for them. Well, then can you say something about that?
Okay, so the question has to do with the idea of arranged marriages and how people in contemporary Western society see things like that. Of course, in society today, there's no compulsion to have arranged, you know, marriages. As I said, it was a feature of Vedic culture. It's still very prominent among Hindu families today. But of course, we see that in modern society, you know, even, you know, among Hindu families and other people, these things, sometimes they're not observed. But even today, to a large extent, in pious Hindu families, the idea of arranged marriage is sort of assumed. Both the families sort of assume it, the boys sort of assume it, the girls sort of assume it, that at a certain stage in their life, parents or other relatives will help them find a husband or a wife. And until that time, they're expected to, not just be running around and sleeping with each other and things like that. In pious Hindu families, that's considered to be still not very good. Although, you know, as times change and people, you know, get exposed to the contemporary culture, maybe that changes a little bit. But the basic idea was that the, and of course they also have this idea of an extended family, which is something which isn't very common in the world today. But they would try to find someone who would be suitable, you know, for their son or daughter in terms of their social status, their moral status, their personalities. And as I said, it's still quite common, even here in the West, you know, among pious Hindu families to have arranged marriages. Of course, there's no way to enforce that on anyone. Anyone can do what they like. But still it seems to be that many prefer to do it that way. Yes.
Isn't it also that there would be astrological calculations for the boy and girl?
Yes, that's traditionally that's also a part of it. You know, to see that, you know, the prospective couple are compatible, you know, astrologically. Yes.
And also, generally, people in the West think that, well, if I choose my mate, then it would seem like it would be a better, that it would work out better. And we're saying that, you know, better that it's, you know, through astrology or, you know, seeing that they're compatible like that. But just like in the families now, the mother and father are not chosen by the children, right? So they don't choose who their mother and father is, but still there's a lot of affection, you know, throughout the Western society. They don't choose who their brother or sister is going to be, but still there's a lot of affection. So similarly, we don't, according to Vedic standard, we don't choose who the wife or husband is going to be, but still there's a lot of affection if it's done through higher understanding.
Well, even according to the Vedic culture, there were different methods of marriage. Some of them were based on personal choice. Like, you know, for example, in the royal families, there would be, in ancient times anyways, not so much today, but, you know, if we, you know, read through the Srimad Bhagavatam, we see that, say, a princess in a royal family would be given a chance to choose her own husband. Usually it was called a swayamvara, which means her own choice, which means that, you know, the different princes would come and more or less compete for, you know, the opportunity to be the husband of this princess, and she would choose, you know, which one would be, you know, her husband. So even in the Vedic culture, there were different processes, you know, for different social classes and different kinds of individuals. But for most ordinary people, this system of arranged marriages was very, very common. Yes. Archita.
We have one from the internet. It's not directly related to what you said today, but it is related to something you said in a previous class. The person says that in a recent class, you said that the best proof of the existence of God is that we exist. because everything has a source. And then they ask, why does everything have to have a source?
Well, we observe that everything does have a source. Everything comes from something. We see that most things in our experience have some cause, have some source. So it seems to be a reasonable assumption that if everything we observe has some cause, has some source, in other words, this book has some source, this anything I see around me has some source. Even the natural things like clouds, you know, they have some source. You know, they come from water, you know, that's evaporated from the ocean. Where's the rivers come from? They come from snow that's accumulated on the mountains. I mean, it seems that everything we observe has some cause or some source. So why should our conscious selves be any exception to what we generally observe about everything, namely that it has some source, has some cause? So then we have to study, well, what is capable of being the source of something? Whatever the source is has to have, you know, the capability of producing something. So I was just making the observation that we are conscious selves, we're individual and personal, and that would suggest that our source must also be something that's conscious, individual, and personal. So that source of all conscious beings is what I would call God. Somebody else? Yes?
I met an individual on campus a couple of days ago who asked me, he was a devotee, he asked, he said he's going to get his degree, so probably marriage life will continue after that. So he asked me what are the proper steps that he should do for that, and since I've never been married and I don't desire to be married, I never inquired on that, so I couldn't give him an answer. So on a practical level, we see that you know, the proper Vedic way, we're supposed to be married, of course, remain married to that one person. What are the proper steps for somebody like that to take so that in the future I might be able to guide somebody in that direction properly?
Well, as I mentioned, it's not that everyone is enjoined to become married. For some people, the best path of life is celibate life, brahmacharya or sannyas, so that's also there. But for most people, at some point in their life, they do become married. And in contemporary society, there's I don't think there's just one rule, you know, that, you know, one can say one should do it. For example, if one is, say, coming to this temple and they're from a Hindu family, they would probably naturally assume that their parents would help them in finding a husband or wife. If one isn't from a pious Hindu family, a Vaishnava family, then if one's just a student at a university, well, just try to find someone who shares your values. You know, for example, like if you're becoming a member of the Krishna consciousness movement, a member of the Hare Krishna movement, and you've become a vegetarian, and you've following the rest of our principles, like no meat eating, no intoxication, no gambling, no illicit sex life, then, you know, if you're looking among your acquaintances for someone to marry, it would be good to have someone who shares your values. Because otherwise it can become, you know, very, you know, problematic that you're attracted to a person on some level, but that person really doesn't share your values, then it can become very difficult. So I would say try to find someone who shares your values. If you're in a temple community living in the ashrams here, then you don't have that same freedom to go searching for whoever you like, whenever you like. You know, things generally have to go through not, you know, your parents arranging it, but, you know, the temple authorities would have to be, you know, consulted about how to go about that, or one spiritual master could also be consulted, you know, like about how to go about these things. But generally, I wouldn't say that there's one thing, there's just one answer that could be given to that question. It all depends upon where the person is situated, what their who their parents are, what their culture is, what their situation is. But in all cases, I think it would be good to hope, you know, that what one should be looking for in a partner is someone who shares one's values and that can help one on the path to going back home, back to Godhead. Okay, Srila Prabhupada ki jai.
If our guest could just remain seated here, we will escort you to the next step. If you just stay here. Okay, thank you.